Hi, so I'm Jen Williams and I'm here today with Jason Blake from iAsme. Jason, would you mind telling us a little bit about what you do at iAsme?
So I've worked for iAsme for just over a year now and I head up the IoT certification scheme.
So tell us a little bit about the scheme and you know who it's suitable for.
So the scheme is aimed at smart devices or IoT devices to certify them against whether that's just the UK law with the baseline level to make sure that they're meeting the top three requirements of the Product Security and Telecommunications Infrastructure Act, or at the assurance level to meet all 13 requirements of the ETSI EN 303645 standard, which is considered by most as the global standard in IoT device security.
Okay, so I suspect lots of people won't have heard of the PSTI Act. Can you tell me a little bit more about what that is?
That assumption would be entirely accurate. A lot of the time when we talk to people, whether that's manufacturers or importers of IoT, not many people have got a working knowledge and have heard of the PSTI Act. The Act basically dictates that whether you're a supplier, a retailer, importer or distributor of IoT, you've got to ensure that the IoT devices that you're selling and to consumers within the UK meet a certain set of technical requirements. And those technical requirements are very, very basic. That the three main elements of the Act are, firstly, that no default password or easily guessable passwords are in use for the devices, and they're not shipped with an admin password such as, admin default 123456. Something that, has been a sort of standard practice from the NCSC for years to make sure passwords are secure. Secondly, to make sure that the device has an accompanying vulnerability disclosure policy and that has a time frame for remediation and that there are clear contact details for who consumers can reach out to should the vulnerability be discovered. And then thirdly is to make sure that at the point of sale that the device has a very clear support period for how long it will receive security updates from the manufacturer. And that's basically the PSTI in a nutshell.
So why do you think it is that so few manufacturers have heard of the PSTI Act?
That's a tough question. I think a lot of it is around the communication from central government. I think there's not been a lot of communication coming from central government about how important this act is. And also I think that the manufacturing industry is so wide and so varied, especially within this country. You might have, multinational conglomerates manufacturing IoT, as well as, one-man band startup businesses manufacturing IoT, because IoT is so cheap to manufacture nowadays. So I think that there's a real problem with getting that information across to everybody that needs to hear it.
So am I right in assuming that one of the iAsme schemes ensures that manufacturers are covering their devices against the requirements of the PSTI Act?
Yes, so our baseline level covers just the top three requirements from the ETSI standard, which are the three requirements of the PSTI Act. And the baseline certification covers everything that you would need as a statement of compliance, and we have, we've spoken to the DCIT and the enforcement body for this, and they're happy to accept that our certification covers everything that a manufacturer will need to prove that their device is compliant with the legislation.
Okay, I know that when Sukarma have spoken to some of the manufacturers that we already work with, a lot of them have been fairly sceptical about enforcement of the Act. We've heard comments such as it'll never be enforced or it'll take a long time for enforcement action to happen. What would you say to those challenges?
Having been in meetings with the enforcement body and the head of the enforcement team, when the enforcement action can begin, which is on the 29th of April this year, there is an enforcement team ready to go. And having spoken with the head of the enforcement team, she's very keen to dismiss those doubters that think, that it'll never be enforced. So actually that, they want to hit the ground running, I think was the term she used, so that they will be looking to ensure compliance with this piece of legislation as soon as it becomes legally enforceable.
And presumably they'll wait for a really good test case to take through the courts.
I would say so. I think that there will be they will take some time to cherry pick a test case, but I would want to say to manufacturers, you don't want to be that test case, because the first time that they go through this, they will have the power to gather enough evidence to ensure that enforcement action is successful. And also, that's where I think the rest of the manufacturing industry wants to be able to say, actually, we're already compliant. We know we're compliant because we've done the IASME scheme, for example, and we've got the certificate from that and that statement of conformity. And I think that's the difference. I think that it might take some time, but I wouldn't want to be a manufacturer that was chancing it'll be okay, it won't be us that's the first test case.
So you suspect that the first manufacturer that's, you know, used as the test case will receive, you know, the highest level of punitive measures?
I would say that's just my opinion, but I would say that that's probably quite fair. You know, the punitive measures range, you know, in fines up to £10 million or 4% of global turnover for a business. So I think that, yeah, I think there's definitely something in that. As an enforcement body, they will want to set the stall out and say, actually, this is enforceable, and we can take you to task over this, and with some quite strong punitive measures.
I think it's also fair to say that there are other routes to compliance for manufacturers. So I know some manufacturers are planning on writing their own statement of compliance. Is that a valid way to meet the obligations under the Act?
As a manufacturer, they are perfectly entitled to write their own statement of compliance. And I think that will work well for some manufacturers. But what they need to remember is they need to have all of the information contained in that statement of compliance. And when the enforcement body does come and say, can we please see your statement of compliance, that actually at that point, if there is anything missing, it's going to be too late. Whereas we already know our certification covers every aspect that a manufacturer needs. And I also think from a cost perspective, writing their own statement of compliance takes their compliance team or whoever it is that's in charge of that. That takes time and research and making sure that they're on top of any changes in the legislation going forward. Whereas our certification, we do all of that. So it outsources and mitigates that risk that they're not going to be compliant with the legislation. And our certification starts at just £450. So actually, it's a very cost-effective way of doing that.
And when you say starts at £450... What do you mean by that? So what does it go up to?
Okay, so the level one, whether that level one is assurance or a baseline, is £450 for a micro organisation of 9 employees or less. And if you are 10 employees or more, that certification is £500.
Okay, so it's still...
It's still a very cost-effective way of doing it.
It's
still a cost-effective option for people, and especially in comparison to, you know, hiring a compliance expert that might know PSTI, but actually then you've got their employment costs and other things to factor in, as well as any changes to the legislation moving forward.
And how would a manufacturer go about purchasing this service where they could get certified?
So there's two options on that basis. They can either make a direct application through IASME and through the IASME website, and that will come in to us and we will assign that to one of our independent assessors. Or the other option is they can approach a certification body like yourselves and say, you know, you offer the IoT certification scheme, can we make an application to get certified through that scheme?
And how many certification bodies are out there at the moment?
Across all of the IASME schemes, we work with around 300 certification bodies. But I think the thing with IoT is it takes quite a level of understanding. So we actually work with a number of certification bodies, but I would say that number is again still growing, because the IoT industry is expanding so rapidly.
So I know that, you know, the proportion of IoT certification bodies is quite small compared to some of the other IASME schemes. How are you making sure that the certification bodies you're working with are of the right quality and have the right level of skills to be able to deliver the programme?
So we have a number of prerequisites for assessors, which they have to have pre-existing qualifications before they can become an assessor. So things such as the ISO 27001 lead auditor is a prerequisite qualification that we accept. But we will review each case as an assessor makes an application to us on a case-by-case basis, because if they maybe don't have a certain qualification, but they can demonstrate a number of years working in the IoT field, then actually that's something that we would review and actually make a decision on a case-by-case basis.
So other than the PSTI Act, are there any other reasons why manufacturers should consider IASME IoT certification?
Absolutely. One of the other biggest drivers that we're finding for the certification scheme is our partnership with Secured by Design, which is the Police Crime Prevention Initiative's commercial division. And they have a secure connected device accreditation, which means that that if a manufacturer were to achieve that, the police can recommend it as a police preferred device. So that, I think, for manufacturers carries a lot of weight to say that their device is police preferred, especially for secure devices such as video doorbells or CCTV cameras. If you're a CCTV manufacturer, to say that you have an accreditation that means your device is police preferred, that says a lot about the quality of the device that you're selling.
And what are IASME doing to help with the communication around, you know, why manufacturers should be certified? What kind of activities are you engaged in?
So one of my biggest things is travelling to events and talking to manufacturers and talking to the people that actually are selling these devices to say, this is something that you need to be aware of. Secured by Design refer clients to us and say, actually, you know, this is a way to achieve the certification that they offer. And again, we post a lot regularly on social media, like a lot of other people do that within the industry, to try to raise the awareness of this legislation, to try and make sure that people are aware of it.
What proportion of new applicants do you think are choosing to certify based on PSTI requirements, and what proportion are certifying for other business reasons?
I think there is still a good proportion of businesses that apply to us for other reasons other than PSTI, because whether it's, for example, we've certified a product previously, and then as soon as they've advertised that they've achieved the certification, we've had their biggest competitor reach out to us and say, actually, we'd like to go through your certification process as well, because it does give people a market edge to say, actually, our device is not only built in whatever manner it is and it's got this accreditation or it's marketed in this way, saying that actually the cybersecurity of it has been taken care of and you've got a certification to validate that. I think that creates, you know, unique selling points for certain manufacturers.
And how would a consumer know when they're buying a product whether it's been through this testing process?
So our certifications can be printed physically on products. They can also be embedded in websites so that consumers can see on the website that actually this device has an accreditation. They can actually click on the interactive certificate and that will take them to the registry where that certificate is held to see that when it was inspected, to see when the certificate was issued and when it expires, so that actually consumers can check that information for themselves.
Yeah, and I think that's probably really important in the area that we live in, where there are kind of thousands upon thousands of devices of varying levels of quality, you know, that are listed for sale.
I think that's really fair, because it doesn't take much to go onto an online retail website, for example, search for smart doorbell, and within seconds you've got thousands of options there, and a lot of it will be price driven for consumers, because the cost of living crisis means that people are always looking at price and making sure that they can afford, making sure they're making the right decisions for their finances. But actually, I would urge so many customers sometimes to just do a little bit of research into the devices that they're buying. Like we've done some market research on devices, and some of the devices that we've found, their website is hosted by a company, or they don't have a website and it's not listed on Companies House, for example, under the trading name that it's selling for, or it's listed as a company that's based in France, and then you look at that and it's actually just the warehouse that it's been held in is based in France, and actually the company's based in China, and actually there's no customer support email address or telephone number. So then if that device breaks, what do you do then? There's no way of receiving any support as a customer, as a consumer, for that device. So then what, do you go and buy another one? Well, then actually you've had to buy two devices. So actually taking that 5 minutes to just research what you're buying and looking at the supplier and what that company is and the reputation that company has, what complaints procedure they've got, for example, it takes 5-10 minutes, and I think it's so worth doing, especially in today's environment where there is, like as you say, there are so many smart devices available. People need to be aware of the ones that they're buying and making sure that they're of good quality.
So what's the worst outcome for a consumer? So let's say they fail to do their due diligence on a product that they're purchasing. They buy something that has weak security. What could happen if they install their device?
An example of that that's been used previously is there was a massive attack on IoT devices, and it was around baby monitors or CCTV cameras. Now, if somebody could hack into your CCTV system that you've installed at your home, and they're monitoring those images just as easily as you are, and you're not aware that they can monitor those devices and monitor those images that the CCTV cameras are recording. If you're going on holiday, for example, which is a valid reason that people install CCTV nowadays, they install it because they're going on holiday, they're going to be away for 2 weeks, and actually they want to make sure that they can monitor that their house is secure while they're on holiday. that actually, if someone's viewing those cameras, they then can see that you've left the house with three suitcases, so they know you're not going to be back, you know, that night, for example. They can turn off your cameras, turn off the recording function so that you can't see it, or actually they could just put it onto a recorded loop that you're just viewing it while they break in and potentially empty your valuables from your property, and that you're not aware of it for 2 weeks. And again, how do you then say to the police, you know, there's no lead on who that is, and that just causes so much stress, and also the feelings of safety and security in your own home. But it goes further than that, that there are so many smart locks nowadays that actually all you need is your phone to open it, and it sends a code to open your front door. Again, those devices can be copied and those devices can be tampered with from a cybersecurity perspective, that anybody can then just walk up to your front door and open that front door. There's a safety risk, there's a security risk, there's then further implications, you know, your car keys, for example, will be in the property. You might be in the property at the time. There's so many issues when you think about it from a security perspective like that.
It's a terrible irony, isn't it, that the consumers are buying devices to secure their homes and are inadvertently introducing new vulnerabilities into their personal security.
Absolutely, and people will go out and buy, like say, CCTV cameras to make sure that their homes are secure, but actually what they're doing is they're inviting in, especially if you're buying unsecure and untested equipment, that actually you're inviting in bigger problems, and that can be massive. Because that they could access your property when you're on holiday, for example. They could then look at they could find your bank statements, your bank details, and there's, you know, that links into fraud. They could take out loans in your name at that point. And all of this happens before you even know anything's gone wrong.
And realistically, do you think the security controls contained within the PSTI Act are enough to make sure that devices are secure?
So you're never going to make a device that's 100% secure, because attackers will always find a way in. But what it does do is it removes that low-hanging fruit, the easy ways in for people. And then actually, if you're an attacker and you attempt to attack a CCTV system and one has security controls in place and it's becoming a little bit of a difficult attack for you, and you try the next one and actually that's a straight-in one and you're straight into that CCTV system, then the people who've got the first one installed, you've prevented that attack without even knowing it, just by having a piece of tested, secure equipment at your house.
So essentially, you're just trying to make your device more secure than your neighbour's device, so that you're not the easy target, and the attacker is essentially operating their own, you know, their business and looking at return on investment. They have to spend a lot more time, energy and effort getting into a device that has some security protection than none. So do you think the PSTI Act goes far enough? Because for me, the only actual technical control on the device is that there'll be a difficult to guess password.
Yeah.
And actually, when you look at the wording of the PSTI Act, it's also acceptable to have no password.
Yes. So do I think the regulations go far enough? No. I think there's 13 requirements for the ETSI standard, which is what the UK IoT law is based from, and PSTI is based off. And I think within those 13 controls, I think at some point the government need to look at introducing more of those controls to make those devices more secure. And I think they've gone with those three for now, because those are the easiest three to implement. And I think it depends on what the take up is from manufacturers to make sure that actually they're doing as the law states. They're introducing these technical controls before the government look to increase that security level. And I think that hopefully manufacturers do take this on board, but I will remain very sceptical on that for now.
Okay, so let's just be really clear as well. To achieve the IASME Level 1 certification, you do have to use some kind of authentication on the device.
Yes.
To say we don't use passwords isn't an acceptable way of kind of removing the need for a good password or a non-guessable password.
No, absolutely. And I would say that the advice and guidance out there for password length and complexity, 12 characters now with numbers and letters and special characters. But that's what we would recommend. But yeah, for the IASME certification, you do need to have a password on the device. It's not something we'll accept to remove the easily guessable passwords, we just removed passwords and authentication altogether.
Yeah, and presumably you can use key pairs as an alternative form of authentication. It doesn't have to be a password.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. It doesn't have to be a password. It can be other forms of authentication, but yeah, That is something that we insist on within the ASME certification.
So for consumers looking to purchase a device, what additional assurance does the IASME assurance scheme provide as opposed to the IASME baseline scheme?
So the assurance scheme would provide a great deal of reassurance to me for consumers, because actually it means that the device has not only met the UK requirements, but it's met all 13 requirements for the leading global standard in IoT. So it means that it's got redundancies in it against power outages. It's got other security measures within it to make sure that it is, again, it's as secure as it possibly can be.
And how's the uptake been from manufacturers of your assurance standard versus the baseline?
What we have found and what's been really positive is more manufacturers are going for the assurance level, because I think they look at it and think, actually, I could do the baseline and I could do just enough route to cover myself against, you know, the UK enforcement body. But if I'm paying this money, I want to make sure that my device is secure, as secure as it possibly can be. And actually, no manufacturer wants their device to be compromised. So therefore, why not do that little bit of extra work to make sure that those devices are as secure as they possibly can be?
Yeah, I think we've definitely seen that at Sakama as well. The vast majority of our clients that are going through certification are going for the level 2 assurance, which involves the hands-on test of the device as well. Can you tell us a little bit about why IASME thought it was important to introduce a hands-on test, you know, for the level 2?
Yes, so the main difference, as you say, from the level 1 is it's an online portal. It's the manufacturer fills in the information and that's then verified by an independent assessor. At the level 2, the manufacturer would ship a copy of the device, or the assessor would go to a site visit with the device and actually conduct an audit of the processes and the documentation around those devices. So it's important from our perspective to make sure that that's done, because on the online portal, you can say, this is where our vulnerability disclosure policy is. We aim to fix all critical vulnerabilities within 24 hours, etc. But unless that's not verified and checked at that point, whereas in the level 2, an assessor would say, okay, can you show me your process involved for remediating the vulnerability and from fixing this issue within 24 hours? If you've done that, show me a work log history that you've actually got of implementing and this changes, and to make sure that your devices the security updates have been issued to fix this vulnerability. So actually, it's really important from our perspective to give more confidence to the consumers that actually these devices have been tested in a hands-on perspective by a trained assessor.
So essentially what you're saying is that the level 1 versions of the scheme test in theory that the controls have been implemented, whereas the level 2, that's actually been verified that they are implemented, they're implemented correctly and they're effective. Is that the idea?
And I think the effective is the key word there, that actually in the level 1, we say, right, where's your vulnerability policy hosted? What are the details around that? So they have to be upfront with that, because obviously that can be checked on the website. So for example, if it's Acme vulnerability disclosure policy, we can find where that's hosted and actually the information around that. But yeah, to be able to then check that in the level 2 basis to make sure that it's effectively being implemented and to make sure those processes are robust enough that if a vulnerability is reported, that actually their staff are, because the staff can be interviewed as well in the level 2 to make sure that their staff know how that's dealt with and how those changes can be implemented and how effective they can be. I think that's really important for consumers to realise.
Is there anything else manufacturers should be doing to secure the business, not just the devices?
Absolutely. There's lots of ways of, looking at business security nowadays. The NCSC scheme, the Cyber Essentials scheme, which is backed by the government, that's something that they should be looking at straight away to say that we've identified that that's a really key business certification.
And is that a prerequisite for the scheme, for the IASME IoT scheme?
So no, it's not a prerequisite, because we don't certify the business, we actually don't certify the device itself. But as a business, if you're concerned about security and you want to achieve a higher level of security as a business, Cyber Essentials and Cyber Essentials Plus, or IASME Cyber Assurance, there are other certifications that you can get for the business that are assigned to the business, not just the device like the IoT scheme, to certify that your business has a higher level of security as well.
Because presumably there's an issue where, however secure the device is, if the business is breached, then the data is also compromised and no longer safe. And actually, it's perfectly possible that somebody could infiltrate the development process or the patching process anyway. So it's probably quite important for manufacturers to cover both elements of security, so the business side and the device side.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's such a good point. Making sure that the business is secure, making sure the development process is secure, and making sure that the update process is secure to make sure that, again, you're removing that low-hanging fruit. You're making sure that your device and your business are secure and are as secure as they can be. And I think Cyber Essentials, Cyber Essentials Plus, the IASME Cyber Assurance, or, you know, something like ISO 27001, are all fantastic business-relevant security certifications before or after looking at the IoT certification for the devices.
And tell me just a little bit to finish off, Jason, about where are IASME's efforts focused this year? I know you said you attend lots of events. Which ones are you going to? Where can people come and find out more about the scheme?
So the next big event we're attending is the National Cybersecurity Show at the NEC in Birmingham. I am actually talking at the co-located event, that the National Security Show, with yourself, Jennifer. You know, we're speaking there, trying to raise the awareness, again, within the physical security realm, that actually there are manufacturers that need to comply with this legislation. So we're speaking there, and I'm sure that we'll have another good speaking engagement, and I'm sure that it'll be another, you know, insightful and helpful talk that, you know, and if people want to come along and talk to us at the NEC, absolutely fantastic. We'll be there to try and help people, again, look at their security of those devices. The only thing I would say is the NEC event is on the 29th of April, which, you know, is the 30th of April, even, but the enforcement bodies can, enforcement action can take place from the day before. So if at that point you want to come and talk to us, that's great, but you know, you are already going to be breaching the law at that point, unfortunately. So we will do our best to try and help as soon as we can.
But better late than never, right?
But better late than never. That is absolutely accurate.
Well, Jason, thank you very much for your time today, and thank you for, you know, giving us your insights. It's much appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you.